From KPFK Pacifica Radio, this is Rising Up with Sonali, and I'm your host, Sonali Kolhatkar. You can watch this program on Free Speech TV and listen to it on Pacifica radio stations and affiliates nationwide. American politics are in trouble. As a nation, we are polarized. We question the truth and are vulnerable to propaganda. We're expected to follow the national discourse on a variety of topics and then show up every couple of years to cast our votes. And this is supposedly how a democracy functions. But what if there was a better way for us to participate in our democracy? What if, instead of vilifying or deifying politicians, we took charge through reasoned debate and deliberation? My guest is James S. Fishkin, the Janet M. Peck Chair in International Communication at Stanford University, where he teaches communication and political science. He also directs the Center for Deliberative Democracy. He's written several books as well as that include Democracy and Deliberation and When the People Speak, Deliberative Democracy and Public Consultation. And he now joins me to discuss his latest book, Democracy When People Are Thinking, Revitalizing Our Politics Through Public Deliberation. Welcome to the program, Jim.
Thank you so much.
Thanks for joining us. So you are also credited with coming up with this idea of deliberative democracy or deliberative polling. What exactly is deliberative polling? The idea goes back as far as the 1980s?
Well, I thought of it in the 1980s, mm-hmm. and I thought I was original. But in fact, the root conception goes back to the ancient Greeks. So I wasn't so original as I thought. But with modern social science, we improve it a lot. The basic idea is, well, first, ordinary polls give you a picture of what the public is thinking if they're done well with good samples and well-formulated questions. But the public is usually not, most of the public in aggregate is usually not thinking very much. Because if you have one vote in millions, the problem is called rational ignorance. If I have one vote in millions, why should I pay a lot of attention to the details of public policy issues or the competing positions of candidates? My individual vote or my individual opinion won't have much effect. So it's more rational for me to focus my time and energy on earning a living, taking care of my family, or doing any of the other things that most of us spend our time on. Only people who are especially and specifically interested in a topic will spend a lot of time on it, but they won't be representative of the rest of the population. So I asked myself the question, what would the people think if they could be engaged to really consider the trade-offs and the competing arguments in a context where they could get good information? And that led me to what I call deliberative polling, which begins with ordinary polling, but then after an initial survey, so that we can see where people start and we can judge the representativeness of those who participate, we gather hundreds of people together who are in the sample who can really consider the issue. We randomly assign them to small groups with moderated discussion with background materials that are balanced, that present the competing sides of an argument that have been vetted by an advisory group. They formulate questions that they direct to competing experts from different points of view who will offer contested answers, but then people will really engage with the competing sides. And most of all, they will talk with each other and discuss the reasons why they might think one policy proposal is a good or a bad idea compared to another. And then we give them a confidential questionnaire at the end with the same questions as when we first recruited them. And we get lots of changes, significant changes of opinion. And those, and not only that, we see what the people would support or buy into when they were really thinking, and we see why. Because we also have the reasons in other questions. We also have the small group discussions where we can look at the transcripts and the reasoning and see what's really moving opinion. And we've done this now 108 times in 28 countries.
This is not just a theory.
Effects.
This is
That's
not
right.
just a theory. This is something that you've actually tested on a limited or in certain specific situations.
Well, we've done it, as I said, in 28 countries, 108 times, every inhabited continent, And we've done it in the U.S. as well, but most recently, my method was applied in South Korea had to decide whether to continue constructing two nuclear reactors or to abandon them, and the government gave it over to a deliberative poll, a national deliberative poll of some 400 citizens who were asked to consider the arguments on either side, and to everyone's surprise, they ended up deciding to continue the construction, and the government accepted that. In Japan, there was an issue about the pension system, whether they would privatize it or not. The ordinary poll said 70% of the people liked the idea of privatizing the pension system, or what we would call Social Security. But when the people really discussed it, with our Japanese partner who convened a sample from Keio University, the support fell from 70% to, I think, something like 29%. And instead,
so you see very dramatic differences in the before and afters.
Oh, yeah, because very often the polls that you normally see are just based on an impression of sound bites and headlines. They look solid mm-hmm. when the numbers are reported, but very often the people aren't paying that much attention. Some people are paying attention, but some people are just giving a vague impression. I'll tell you this, sometimes in ordinary polls, the opinions don't exist at all. That is, George Bishop years ago studied the attitudes towards the so-called Public Affairs Act of 1975, and the people had views about it, but it didn't exist. It was fictional, but they answered anyway. Because nobody wanted to admit that they didn't know about the Public Affairs Act of 1975. The Washington Post celebrated the 20th anniversary of the non-existent Public Affairs Act of 1975 by asking people what they thought of the repeal, telling half the people that the Democrats wanted to repeal it and half that the Republicans did. And they got quite different answers, but it didn't exist in the first place.
Wow. And also, of course, there is polling firms that embed bias in the questions themselves, and we see very different results depending upon how a question might be framed, right?
Oh, yeah. So we work meticulously to try to get well-worded questions, to try to get balanced briefing materials to vet them. But notice our results are before and after. So if there were some bias in the question, once the people really think about it, we would be talking about the change in opinion after they've really engaged in considering both sides of the argument, or whatever, however many sides there are. We think we have a good antidote to bias, and we work really hard to get good samples. A lot of the polling you hear reported has very low response rates, and a lot of them aren't even probability samples, that is random samples, but they're cheap ways of trying to approximate a random sample in the height of an election where you just have to report very quickly. And so we do this all meticulously.
So, James, the current situation that we have today does not require politicians to actually follow the public demands. You know, people would say that some people would say we don't really live in a democracy. We live in a republic, that we have a representative democracy, that oftentimes once lawmakers are elected, they do what they will. They can and should pay attention to what the public actually wants. Sometimes they don't, and sometimes they don't to protect minorities from the majority. How would a deliberative process transform the very fabric, the very basis of how the U.S.'s government system is designed?
Well, going back to the design, Madison, who was the designer in chief, had this idea that the representatives would deliberate. They would refine and enlarge the public views by passing them through the medium of a chosen body of citizens, as he says in Federalist 10. And so we have a lot of institutions where the representatives, especially in the Senate and in the Constitutional Convention and the ratifying conventions, and even in the Electoral College, the electors were supposed to deliberate on the best candidate. But at that point, there were no political parties. And he didn't envision the fact that political parties were going to come along and impose party discipline. The political parties have whips in order to get the representatives not to vote as to their conscience, but to vote as to the party line. So the representatives don't have much incentive to deliberate in our republic. And you're absolutely right. We were founded as a republic, not a democracy, because at that point, democracy had a bad name because, after all, it was equated with mob rule. The people killed Socrates. There was Shay's Rebellion. They were afraid of the angry mob. And so the founders had this indirect idea that the people would elect the state legislatures, the state legislatures would elect the members of the Senate. That was all changed by constitutional amendment later, but it was an indirect filtration model. But the representatives are not deliberating so much because of partisan advantage, polarization, and the electoral incentives not to deliberate, but to do whatever will win elections. So my notion is democracy has to have some connection to the will of the people. And what is the will of the people? Well, everybody's trying to manipulate it, distort it, mislead it. And this goes for party competition democracy. It goes for direct democracy. After all, I live in California, and we all know what happens with ballot propositions. Look at Brexit, we could talk about that. So the idea is to insert the deliberations of a representative microcosm into the policy process and into the political process. And we're doing that in various ways. In fact, in some countries, even officially, we're inserting it, not to replace, but to supplement, because democracy should be about the will of the people, but the people really have to have a chance to think about the issues in order to make their views consequential.
Give us an example, sort of start to finish. You gave some examples earlier, but in the US context, I imagine that if such a process were attempted on a particularly controversial topic, that, I would just be curious to see what the results would be. I mean, there are certain topics that people get extremely emotional about and we're very divided over. And, I'm thinking of abortion, for example. We are, as you and I speak, there's a confirmation process playing out about a judicial, about a Supreme Court nominee who could end up overturning Roe versus Wade. And if this feels like one of those intractable issues that the U.S. could never really come to any consensus on. I mean, how would a process like this, as you're describing in your book, influence a topic like, say, abortion?
Well, I don't know about it. We haven't done abortion, but we have done some very controversial topics in various countries. We've done cooperation on the schooling between Protestants and Catholics in Northern Ireland. We've done the issue of the Roma in Bulgaria, who are very discriminated against. And we did a national project where support changed dramatically for closing down the Roma-only schools, the segregated schools, and busing the Roma children into the schools with everybody else. And the prime minister endorsed that at the time, and that has now actually come to pass. The Roma schools have been desegregated. It's something involving intense feelings. In the U.S., we haven't done such controversial projects, but we have actually had policy impact. Let me tell you about one set of projects that I'm very proud of, which is, but it doesn't, it, it's in terms of the impact, but it's not so controversial. We did a series of projects in Texas on the seemingly boring issue of how each part of the state was going to get its electricity in the future, and that this the Public Utility Commission and the legislature supported the idea that the companies had to consult the public. So how were they going to consult the public? If they had open meetings, they were going to get lobbyists. If they
which is usually what happens.
That's right. If they did polling, the issues were too complicated, and the public, wouldn't understand them. So they did a series of what I call deliberative polls. First, we had an advisory group convened that represented all the options, the environmental groups, the consumer groups, the advocates of alternative energy, the big customers, all the different groups sat at a table and eventually had to agree on arguments for and against each of the options. We convened random samples who would deliberate based on those materials with moderated small groups and panels of competing experts who would answer questions from the small groups over a few days, Friday, Saturday, Sunday usually, and then answer the questionnaire at the end, and the same one that they answered when they were first contacted. And the result was startling in that the percentage of the public willing to pay for wind power or renewable energy and willing to pay more on their monthly bill for wind power, a little bit more, went from about 50% to 85% averaged.
Wow.
The eight projects. And this really impressed the public utility commissioners at the time. Hmm. And it really impressed the plans that were filed all involved big increases in wind power, as well as big increases in conservation. And you know, conservation and wind power are both very good for the environment. And coal went way down the priority list. And also investments in natural gas to make up the difference in terms of what they need. And natural gas is much cleaner than coal. So this was very good for the environment. And the results kept being used and invoked by the commission and the legislature to the point that Texas went from being number 50 out of the 50 states, that is last, to being number one among the 50 states in 2007 in the amount of wind power. And Texas has increased considerably since based on the momentum there. So we think we changed the energy portfolio of the state, and it was very good for the environment, very good for clean air, and very good for climate change. So that's the example of a complicated issue that if you just did polling about, you would probably get noise. If you had organized open meetings, you'd probably get lobbyists. And so this is a way to have an input into real decision making.
So can you also tell me about the situation in Mongolia, which I understand is one of the perhaps only countries where this idea of deliberative polling has actually been institutionalized and where the government is now, you know, put it into law that they will use this process to decide policy issues?
It's required by law. Before the parliament can consider an amendment to the constitution, it now has to convene a national deliberative poll to consider the proposals and, based upon the results, decide whether to pass the amendment. And we did the project with partners in Mongolia, in the Mongolian government and the Asia Foundation, and it was very successful, and the result is now about to be voted on by the parliament for an amendment that I think is different from what either of the major parties envisioned, but it's very substantive. And if this passes, I'm going back to Mongolia for a big conference about this in October, and if this passes, it will be the first time that a scientific random sample of the citizens has been deliberating and will have produced a constitutional amendment.
I suppose it sounds like something that one would, if this were instituted in the United States, something akin to serving on a jury. You get called in for jury duty, you get called in for deliberative polling, and presumably you get some sort of compensation for your time, and you spend a weekend thinking about an important issue as part of this random sampling.
Exactly. And of the 730-some who were selected by the National Statistical Office, I think only two refused to take the initial interview, and about 690 came for the three-day weekend from all over the country. And by the way, Mongolia is a competitive democracy with a private property market system, with problems of corruption, tabloid news media, social media spreading misinformation, all the problems that we know about. And they've really set an example by institutionalizing this. And this was the largest deliberative poll ever, the nearly 700 who deliberated. And the results make a tremendous amount of sense. So I'm hoping it will set an example for how this can be inserted in various contexts around the world.
Well, finally, Jim, because, of course, we live in such a difficult time here in the U.S., what is the chance that such a thing could become institutionalized here in the U.S.? Is there, you know, given the example in Texas that worked out so successfully, are there state-level efforts that could begin to insert this into our political system and to our political thought processes?
Sure. There's a state-level effort in California that's described in the book that actually was meant both to produce a ballot proposition, but also to influence the legislature. And it did influence the legislature, it did map out changes in the initiative process, which actually were passed by the legislature. Causality is always hard to attribute here, but there were certain reforms of some of the craziness in our initiative system that were changed that conform perfectly in terms of more transparency for the donors, the ability to change a proposition once the signatures are already collected, and things of that sort that before were a little bit too rigid. And my hope is to do more in California, but also to do more on the national level in the U.S. So we're actively experimenting and seeking out ways to insert this kind of process without scuttling our current institutions, but rather in the spirit of supplementing them and giving the informed voice of the people as an input.
Right, so it doesn't have to replace it, but at least give us some informed results by which politicians can make a commitment to actually, you know, have their policies shaped by. Well, finally, Jim, give out the website for the organization that you run in Stanford, the Center for Deliberative Policy, and in addition to the Center for Deliberative Democracy, which people can check out in addition to getting a copy of your book.
Yes, it's you want the website. It's http://cdd.stanford.edu. No www for some reason. Center for Deliberative Democracy. You can just Google that, and you'll see. If you go under locations, you'll see projects all over the world, and a lot of this is described in my new book, Democracy When the People Are Thinking.
We'll post a link to the website as well as information about your book on our website. Thank you so much for joining us, Jim. Good luck to you.
Thank you.
My guest is James S. Fishkin. He's the Janet M. Peck Chair in International Communication at Stanford University, where he teaches communication and political science. He also directs the Center for Deliberative Democracy, and we're talking about his new book, Democracy When People Are Thinking, Revitalizing Our Politics Through Public Deliberation. I'm Sonali Kolhatkar. We're online at risingupwithsonali.com, where you can sign up for our daily newsletter, subscribe to our audio podcast on iTunes, and our video channel on Vimeo.